Okay, so think about this. We all carry these miniature supercomputers in our pockets, right? We navigate this huge global web of information. We rely on digital tools pretty much daily. But have you ever stopped to wonder how this whole digital revolution really came about? Was it just a few lone geniuses having these sudden eureka moments? Or maybe something, I don't know, far more intricate, more collaborative, and frankly, messier? Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we unpack your source material, pull out those really crucial nuggets of knowledge, and basically give you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed. Today, we're diving into Walter Isaacson's, well, remarkable work, The Innovators, how a group of hackers, geniuses, and geeks created the digital revolution. And look, this isn't just a history book, not just a timeline. It's really a profound look at how humanity invents, how we build things, and it challenges some pretty popular myths along the way. So our mission today is to unpack Isaacson's main argument, that this digital age we live in, it wasn't born from just isolated flashes of brilliance. No, it came from a long, pretty complex, and deeply collaborative process. We'll explore that dynamic between the visionaries and the engineers, you know, the dreamers and the doers. We'll look at how hardware and software sort of grew up together, and the absolutely critical role that openness and teamwork played in shaping, well, the world we know now. So if you're curious about the real story behind the tech that defines our lives, or maybe you're looking for new ways, new blueprints to spark creativity and innovation in your own work, then yeah, this deep dive is definitely for you. All right, so to really get into this digital tapestry, we kind of have to challenge some of our assumptions right off the bat. Isaacson's main point here, it's a direct pushback against what he calls the lone genius's myth, isn't it? We love those stories, right? Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, these solitary inventors. But Isaacson paints a very, very different picture.
Yeah, and what's so fascinating is Isaacson's unique position to even make this argument. I mean, this is the guy who wrote the definitive biographies of people like Jobs, Einstein, Franklin, you know, singular figures. But here in The Innovators, he deliberately shifts focus. He wants to show that the digital revolution was, well, fundamentally a team sport, a relay race, as he puts it, stretching across generations. He's really tackling that problem of, you know, simplifying history too much, showing that these big breakthroughs, they come from creative friction, from synergy, from people working together, often arguing, not just someone having a light bulb moment in isolation. His core idea is that innovation is this continuous chain. It's cumulative. Each breakthrough kind of enables the next one. And often it's by standing on the shoulders of countless, often forgotten collaborators.
That's a really powerful counter-narrative. So what's an early example Isaacson uses, something that really hammers home this idea of collaboration right from the start, maybe something that surprises people?
Oh, he takes us way back to the 1840s with Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace. Now, Babbage, he was brilliant, absolutely, but also famously difficult. A mathematician focused on designing this analytical engine. He was the classic engineer, you know, deep in the weeds of the hardware. But then you have Ada Lovelace, daughter of Lord Byron, a poet mathematician, and she saw its potential far beyond just crunching numbers. And Isaacson shows this wasn't just some abstract idea, it was a huge conceptual leap. She realized, okay, if this machine can manipulate numbers, then theoretically it could manipulate any symbols, words, music, art, anything. That insight fundamentally changed the definition of computing. It went from being a fancy calculator to a general purpose symbol manipulator. That's the foundation for basically everything we do with computers now. Her concept of poetical science, it wasn't just a nice phrase, it was a deep philosophical insight into the machine's true huge potential. So that partnership, right there at the dawn, combining the technical skill with the imaginative vision, it perfectly sets up the book's main theme.
Poetical science. I like that. It sounds almost, well, poetic. Was there pushback, though? I mean, did Babbage, the practical engineer, immediately get this grand vision? Or was there some, you know, productive friction there, too?
Oh, absolutely. That's a key point. Babbage, brilliant as he was, sometimes struggled to see past the immediate math problems. Lovelace often had to, well, nudge him, push him to grasp the bigger picture, the wider implications. And that tension, the visionary pushing the engineer grounding the visionary, that dynamic shows up again and again throughout Isaacson's book. It sort of becomes a blueprint for how innovation actually happens. It shows that collaboration isn't always smooth sailing. Sometimes that creative friction, that little bit of conflict, is exactly what sparks the best ideas.
Okay, so Babbage and Lovelace, that foundational pair, they really set the stage. Because from there, Isaacson takes us on this incredible journey, almost 2 centuries long, showing how everything connects, how each breakthrough sort of enables the next one. It's like this amazing tapestry he weaves.
It really is. And if you connect the dots, you see how each step builds on the last. Often you had multiple teams, sometimes working in parallel, sometimes even as rivals, but they were all, in a way, contributing to this shared evolving goal. It's this massive century and a half story of how an idea, the programmable networked personal computer, actually became reality.
Right. Lovelace plants the seed, this idea of the universal machine. But it kind of lies dormant for a while, doesn't it? Maybe waiting for the right moment, the right pressure. Mm-hmm. And that seems to come in the 1930s and 40s with World War II.
Exactly. The theoretical groundwork gets laid by Alan Turing, his incredible 1936 paper on the universal computing machine. Pure concept. But then, yeah, World War II hits. Suddenly, there is this urgent, practical need for complex calculations, especially for things like artillery trajectories. That's when machines like ENIAC pop up, funded by the U.S. Army. And Isaacson really emphasizes this wasn't one person's invention. It was a huge team effort. Dozens of engineers and, crucially, six brilliant women who were initially hired as computers, literally people who calculated, who then became its first programmers. And these women, they weren't just button pushers. They were pioneers. They were figuring out how to wire it, how to debug it, essentially inventing OLE programming techniques on the fly. Their hands-on work, their collaboration was absolutely essential.
Wow. And then from that giant room-filling hardware, the focus starts shifting pretty quickly to making these machines usable, right? Mm-hmm. To programming and software. And there's another remarkable figure there.
Yeah, that leads us straight to Grace Hopper. A Navy Rear Admiral, a computer scientist, just an amazing figure. She firmly believed that computers shouldn't just be for elite mathematicians in labs. They needed to be more accessible. So her groundbreaking work, she created the compiler. You can think of it like a universal translator. It let programmers write instructions in something resembling human language, like simple English commands, ADD, XTOY, instead of pages of complex, error-prone binary code. This was absolutely revolutionary. It basically democratized computing, opened it up way beyond just the specialists. It paved the way for the entire software industry, really, allowed for much more complex programs, more sophisticated uses. And yeah, the famous story about her finding a moth in a relay, that's where we get the term debugging, kind of captures her very practical, hands-on approach.
Ah, debugging. Love that. Okay, so we have the theory, the first machines, the first software. Then comes miniaturization, right? Making these things smaller, faster, more powerful, taking them out of the giant rooms.
Exactly. Enter the transistor. Invented at Bell Labs, 1947, William Shockley, John Bardeen, Walter Bratton. Isaacson tells this story, and it's full of tension, competition, but ultimately it's this intense collaboration within Bell Labs, an environment designed specifically to encourage these kinds of breakthroughs. Shockley was brilliant but difficult, often clashed with Bardeen and Bratton, but sometimes that very friction, that intellectual sparring, led to the breakthroughs. Their work won a Nobel Prize, but it was just one step, because then, about a decade later, 1958, you get the microchip. And incredibly, it's invented almost simultaneously by Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments and Robert Noyce at Fairchild Semiconductor. Two different people, two different places, same idea around the same time. That invention, the integrated circuit, unleashed Moore's Law, that observation that computing power roughly doubles every couple of years. It made modern electronics possible. And interestingly, Robert Noyce's management style at Fairchild and later at Intel, which was much more collaborative, less hierarchical, that became really characteristic of Silicon Valley.
Okay, and that microchip, that miniature miniaturization that directly leads to the personal computer revolution in the 70s, right? When things really start moving from the lab and the corporation into people's homes, into garages.
Precisely. The microprocessor made computing affordable enough for individuals, for hobbyists. And that sparked this incredibly vibrant movement. People building kit computers like the Altair 8800 in their garages, just tinkering, exploring. And out of that environment come two of the most iconic partnerships. You have Steve Wozniak, the engineering genius, just loving building things, designs the Apple IN2. And then you have Steve Jobs, the intense visionary, who sees the potential to package it, market it, make it user-friendly for ordinary people. It turns the hobbyist's toy into a real consumer product.
It's that Lovelace-Babbage dynamic all over again, isn't it? That perfect blend of deep technical skill and market-shaping vision.
It really is. And right around the same time, there's another pair looking at these new machines and seeing a slightly different future, focusing not just on the box, but what runs on the box. That's Bill Gates and Paul Allen. They looked at these new personal computers, like the Altair, and realized, hey, these things are basically useless without software that people can actually use. So they famously drop out of Harvard, create a version of the basic programming language for the Altair. They made this huge, far-sighted bet that the real value, long-term, was going to be in the software, not just the hardware. They saw that the power wasn't just the machine itself, but what you could do with it.
Okay, so we have personal computers starting to spread. The next logical step seems to be connecting them all together, creating a network, the internet, And that story, again, it sounds like another huge collaborative effort, maybe starting in unexpected places.
Oh, definitely. The initial vision, Isaacson credits it largely to J.C.R. Licklider. He was actually a psychologist at MIT. And back in the early 1960s, he envisioned this intergalactic computer network. It sounds like science fiction, right? But then he went to head a department at the Pentagon's Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA. And from there, he funded the research that led to ARPANET. But crucially, ARPANET wasn't built by some top-down military command. It was built by this loose, collaborative community of graduate students, researchers at different universities. Figures like Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn developed the core protocols, TCP/IP, that still run the internet today. And the design itself, this open, decentralized network with no single point of failure, that was a philosophical choice as much as a technical one. It was designed to be resilient, and that very openness allowed it to grow explosively in a really democratic way. That early decision to be open was just critical.
And that open, decentralized spirit just kept going, didn't it?
Yeah.
Culminating in the World Wide Web, which is what really brought the internet to, well, everyone.
It absolutely did. And that's thanks largely to Tim Berners-Lee working at CERN, the physics lab in Switzerland. He invented the three core things we still use constantly, URLs, HTTP, and HTML, the addresses, the transfer protocol, the page language. But here's the really crucial part, linking back to Isaacson's theme. Berners-Lee deliberately chose not to patent it. He released it all for free. He wanted it to be a universal standard, something anyone could build on without asking permission. That decision enabled this incredible wave of permissionless innovation. Then you had Marc Andreessen and his team at the University of Illinois create Mosaic, the first popular graphical web browser. That transformed the internet from mostly text into the clickable visual thing we know today. Huge moment for adoption. Made it accessible, inviting.
Just amazing. And then to kind of wrap up this whole historical journey, Isaacson points to two giants that really embody that collaborative potential of the web itself, Google and Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. Larry Page and Sergey Brin's Google search, especially their PageRank algorithm, was revolutionary precisely because it was collaborative at its core. It basically crowdsourced relevance. It counted links from other sites as votes, harnessing the collective judgment of the entire web to figure out what was important. And then Jimmy Wales and Larry Sanger with Wikipedia, they took collaboration to maybe its ultimate extreme, a global encyclopedia that anyone could edit. It was based on this really radical belief in the power of collective knowledge of mass participation. These two, Google and Wikipedia, they're maybe the ultimate demonstrations of Isaacson's whole argument how innovation truly flourishes through distributed intelligence, through shared effort, through connection.
It's staggering when you stop and think about it. Just one quick search on your phone or sending an email. Think of all the layers, all the different people and ideas across decades that had to come together for that single moment to happen. It's really astounding. So, okay, we've traced this incredible history. Beyond the specific stories, the timelines, Isaacson pulls out these really powerful kind of overarching themes about innovation itself. What are the big lessons here? What can we take away from this, you know, century and a half saga that applies today in any field?
Yeah, that's the crucial question, right? What are the universal takeaways? Isaacson identifies several key themes that run through the entire narrative. And the first one, the absolute foundation, as we've been saying, is that innovation is fundamentally a collaborative process. Every single major breakthrough he looks at, it came from teams. Often messy teams, teams with disagreements, but teams nonetheless. He just relentlessly dismantles that romantic lone genius's myth and replaces it with something far more accurate and I think ultimately more inspiring, this idea of collective achievement.
And it's not just having a team, but the kind of people on that team seems really important too, right? Yeah. There's that specific pairing that keeps popping up.
Precisely. That's the second big theme, the marriage of visionaries and engineers. Progress needs both. It needs the people who can imagine what technology could do, you know, the Lovelaces, the Licklider's, the Jobses, dreaming of the future. But it also absolutely needs the people with the technical genius to actually build it. The Babbages, the Wozniaks, the transistor inventors. Isaacson shows that innovation sparks right at that intersection, where the wild ideas meet the practical know-how, where dreams get grounded in reality.
And the technology itself, hardware and software, they're locked in this constant dance, pushing each other forward.
That's theme number three, the symbiosis of hardware and software. He calls it a co-evolutionary dance, which I think is a great way to put it. Powerful new hardware makes more complex software possible. And then ambitious new software ideas demand better, faster hardware. They're constantly pushing each other. You can't really understand the progress of one without looking at the other. Isaacson traces that intricate dance beautifully through the decades.
We also touched on the power of openness quite a bit. How central is that theme?
Oh, hugely central. That's the fourth theme, the power of openness and decentralization. It's a recurring pattern. Isaacson shows again and again, open systems tend to win out over closed, proprietary ones in the long run. Think about the internet's decentralized design, built to withstand failures. Think about Tim Berners-Lee giving away the web protocols that allowed for this explosion of creativity. Anyone could jump in and build something new. It's a stark contrast to those walled gardens closed systems where innovation is controlled by one company, which often seem to lag behind or get overtaken.
Right. And what about the funding? Especially for those really big, risky, long-term projects where maybe the commercial payoff wasn't obvious at first. Who was bankrolling that?
Yeah. That leads to the fifth theme, which Isaacson calls the triple helix of innovation. It's this powerful synergy, this interplay between three key players. First, you need government funding, especially for that long-term, high-risk basic research, like the Pentagon funding ARPANET. Second, you need academic institutions, universities, fostering open inquiry, allowing people to explore ideas freely. And third, you need the private sector, companies that can take those fundamental breakthroughs and turn them into actual products, scale them up for the market. Isaacson argues that the digital revolution couldn't have happened without all three working together, sometimes intentionally, sometimes accidentally.
And the last big theme, it feels like it's less about sudden eureka moments and more about building blocks.
Exactly right. The sixth theme is seeing innovation as an evolutionary process. Progress isn't usually these isolated bolts from the blue. It's incremental. Each new idea builds on what came before it. Isaacson gives the example of Vannevar Bush's 1945 essay about the Memex, this theoretical personal knowledge device. That essay inspired later pioneers like Douglas Engelbart, who invented the mouse and early hypertext, and Engelbart's work inspired others. It's this long chain, stretching back decades, each generation adding a new link. It's about persistence, about iterating, improving.
These themes, they feel like they're not just about tech history. They sound like, well, blueprints for innovation that could apply anywhere, really, from a startup trying to build something new to scientists tackling a disease. So this deep dive, it's definitely not just about looking back. It's got to be about looking forward, too. So let's bring it home. What does all this mean for you, the listener, whether you're working in tech or you're an aspiring innovator or maybe just someone trying to make sense of our digital world?
Yeah, I think Isaacson's work offers some really practical, actionable guidance. For anyone trying to create something new, lead a team, or just learn effectively in this complex world, if you're a business leader, an entrepreneur, the clear message is build diverse teams. Deliberately bring together those engineers and those visionaries. Embrace management styles that are less about top-down hierarchy and more collaborative, like Robert Noyce did at Intel. And don't be afraid of a little creative friction. Sometimes that's where the best ideas come from. Also, look for ways to partner with universities, with government labs, maybe even with competitors on pre-competitive research.
Okay, and for us as individuals,
yeah,
in our own careers, or even just how we approach projects, what's the personal takeaway?
I think it's about shifting your mindset a bit. Moving away from chasing individual glory and really learning to value teamwork, collective success, appreciating that you're building on the work of others and being willing to share your own work generously so others can build on it too, and cultivate that cross-disciplinary curiosity Isaacson talks about becoming those T-shaped individuals. You know, having broad knowledge across different fields, the top of the T, combined with deep expertise in one area, the vertical part. He argues that an engineer who also understands art or a designer who gets the basics of code, they're much more likely to spot connections, to create something truly novel because they can bridge different worlds.
And thinking even bigger picture for policymakers, for educators shaping the next generation, what lessons should they take from this history?
Well, definitely recognizing the huge long-term payoff from government investment in fundamental scientific research. That basic R&D often seems abstract, but it lays the foundation for future industries, just like ARPANET did for the internet and for education. It's a strong argument for championing an interdisciplinary approach, breaking down the silos between humanities and sciences. Think back to Ada Lovelace's poetical science. We need education that values both analytical thinking and creative imagination, preparing people to tackle complex problems holistically, collaboratively.
It really does sound like a powerful recipe for personal creativity and problem solving, too.
Absolutely. It encourages you to connect ideas from fields you normally wouldn't put together, to actively look for collaborators whose skills and perspectives are different from yours, who complement what you bring, and maybe most importantly, to understand that big, meaningful projects are usually marathons, not sprints. persistence matters. Learning from failures matters. Being willing to be part of a long, ongoing story is key. And it also hints at the potential, right? While technology definitely has its downsides and serious ethical questions we need to grapple with, Isaacson's story shows its fundamental democratic potential. When designed with that open spirit, it really can give more people access to information, to tools, to platforms. It can shift power away from just centralized institutions towards individuals and communities.
Yeah, it really highlights that your own unique perspective, combined with a willingness to team up with others, those are incredibly powerful assets in the world today. So the innovators, it leaves you with this profound appreciation for just how powerful collaboration can be. It gives you a new way to think about how innovation really happens. It's not the lone genius in the garage struck by lightning. No, it's this messy, interconnected network of thinkers and dreamers and builders, all standing on each other's shoulders, passing the baton across generations. Isaacson's book really shifts the focus, doesn't it? From the individual star to the collaborative team as the real engine of progress. So maybe here's something to think about. What collaborative potential might you be overlooking in your own work, in your own life? And how might deliberately bringing diverse minds together actually redefine what's possible in your world?